From KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. We're all familiar with the term LEED, or leadership in energy and environmental design. Many buildings and structures around the county are either LEED certified or designed and constructed to its specifications.
But few are probably aware of the U.S. Green Building Council, who helped develop the LEED process, and fewer still are aware of the fact that the green building industry found its start with one man with an idea and a mission.
David Gottfried woke up in the middle of the night back in 1992 with the idea of establishing an organization and a process by which buildings could receive reward and recognition for being designed, constructed, and operated in the most energy and material efficient manner as possible.
Gottfried then went on to write a book about his journey from real estate developer to founder of the U.S. Green Building Council and the LEED certification process. It's titled Explosion Green, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry. David Gottfried joins us in the first half of the show.
Then in the second half of the show, we're going to discuss yesterday's announcement from the White House and the EPA about the proposal to reduce carbon emissions from U.S. power plants. We're going to share with you the five things, at least five.
A minimum of five things.
12, but we'll try to keep it down to around five or between 5 and 10 things you need to know about what this proposal does and does not do.
So we'll have all that, plus some news highlights, including two counties in Oregon that recently voted to ban genetically engineered plants, or GMOs, genetically modified organisms, in their counties and where that's going, China's record-breaking high temperatures, and California's recent drought and its impacts on water quality.
Who knew? Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. It all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Jeff from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates, and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson.
That's right.
Co-host. It's a weekly talk show on environmental issues and the concepts of sustainability. So in the introduction, we talked about the concept of LEED. It's an acronym for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And it's headed up or was established by the U.S. Green Building Council back a while ago. And so there is there's an individual though who's behind all of this, David Gottfried.
That's right.
He's going to be joining us shortly. We're trying to get him on the phone. He'll be calling from back east. But so while we have it now, in fact, your building that you work at, the Swanner Eco Center, is LEED.
That's right. It's LEED Platinum. And it was actually the first LEED Platinum new construction building in Utah. But we're excited about this topic, I think, in general, because there are a lot of LEED buildings here in the state.
That's right. And that's what we're going to talk to David Gottfried. Yeah, David Gottfried joins us by phone. Thanks, Dave, for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth this morning.
Oh, great to be here. I love the title of your show.
Thank
exactly.
you.
Exactly. It kind of fits in with your goals and your mission. You know, in the introduction, we gave a little background on what LEED is, and there are many buildings. The building that Nell works in is a LEED certified building, and we'll get to that in a minute. But But we want to talk about your book that just came out. It's called Explosion Green, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry. And let's start here. You came into kind of the real estate development world back in the 80s. What did the let's call it the green building landscape look like back then?
Well, I started at it in real estate in 82. Mm-hmm. Right at that time, recycling had just pretty much been invented. And some buildings, some homes, some communities were recycling. You may recall we had to throw our bottles and our plastic jugs in our car and right. drive them somewhere. I used to love throwing the glass into those bins and breaking them. we tightened up buildings in the 80s because of the 70s energy crisis and oil crisis. So we tightened up our buildings so we'd use less energy. But what we did is we stopped the fresh air circulation. Mm-hmm. So we created sick building syndrome, and that hit in the 80s. And if you started to glue the waste recycling together with the sick building syndrome, and then we had some water shortages. I remember one in the 70s in Los Angeles. If you glued them all together, you started to get the start of green building.
Right. So there were some, let's say, architects or engineers who saw this as an opportunity or something to pursue. But then you kind of coalesce that all eventually, as you describe, almost in the middle of the night, you came up with this idea, which eventually became the Green Building Council.
Yes, it was myself and a couple other co-founders. We played off of other things that were happening in the world. The first step towards green building came out of the UK in the late 80s, real early 90s. They started the BREEAM, which was the first rating system in the world for green building. And then in the U.S. around 91, 92, the American Institute of Architects started their Committee of the Environment. And then we played off of those, but we went a little more horizontal. Instead of just being architects or government, we identified the 13 sectors of the building industry and pulled them together under a rating system, under a nonprofit coalition, and that became the USGBC, and then we invented the LEED rating system. Mm-hmm.
So give us an overview of what the USGBC looks like today and what LEED is.
Mm-hmm. Sure. USGBC today just celebrated, we're in our 21st year, which is very exciting. We have about 280 staff all over the U.S. We have 80 chapters with green building councils. I'm sure you have one where you're residing, and probably everyone listening has one.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We have LEED, which now has about 6 different versions, whether it's new construction, existing buildings, LEED EB or EBOM, we call it, LEED for homes, LEED for neighborhoods. We have LEED for interiors, so it's gone crazy. We have about 300,000 LEED buildings in 140 countries with 11 billion square feet. We have the LEED accredited professional and green associate with 200,000 have passed that exam all over the world. We had Green Build annual conference, which is now going global. Last year was Philadelphia. This year is October in New Orleans. Mm. And we'll have 25,000 people come to that. And so it's really just proliferated. And I took the Green Building Council model of the U.S. about 15 years ago and created the World GBC. And there are 100 countries with Green Building Councils, including China and India and Africa and Mexico, and just everywhere. So it's really quite exciting.
Great. Well, so let's go back to when you were first starting your efforts, and you had a lot of people to convince that this was a worthwhile venture, and to get involved. You tell an interesting story in the book about your meeting with someone at the World Watch Institute, right? An environmental organization whose mission it is to protect the environment. And you went there to try to sell them on the advantages of greening their office space, that they were looking for new office space, their, you know, their energy, their water conservation, perhaps some of their materials, their paints and rest. And it described kind of that meeting and the response you got from that person.
Yeah, I'll never forget that story. And it was a sad day. Yeah. World Watch does incredible work.
Yes.
Their book, State of the World, Vital Signs. They're my Bible. They're really still the best statistics for anyone who wants to know the state of the world, especially our annual changes. But I knocked on their door without them requesting it and decided they should green their new space, which they were doing a renovation. And we had seen the plans and specifications come to our construction firm. And I voluntarily just changed their design to be green, mm-hmm. and thought I could easily sell it to them. But I ran into kind of a bean counter CFO who was all about budget, schedule, risk, mm-hmm. and get it done. And she didn't really reflect the culture of their mission.
Right, that planet versus profit thing, that probably not the first time or last time you're faced with that challenge. Like, we want to do the right thing, but if it's costing us additional money that we don't have, then we can't do it.
Yeah, and we were very, very early. LEED wasn't out yet, and green building wasn't known, although the utilities were doing a lot of energy efficiency at that time with rebates. But I was astounded that I couldn't break through, mm-hmm. but I was pigeonholed with that person who was hired to run the project, not sitting alongside the person writing their books.
Right.
And sometimes we see that at great universities where mm-hmm. they have phenomenal sustainability, architecture, engineering curriculum that could be steeped in green education, and then you run into the facilities person who doesn't believe in it.
Oh, sure.
Sure. I mean, was that indicative or representative of those early days of LEED, trying to explain to people what that meant and what that could mean for them? Did you encounter a fair bit of resistance?
Enormous. Even if you look at our growth chart for the USGBC in terms of members, in terms of LEED adoption, it's the typical innovation curve that's fairly flat and slope for an initial period of time until it looks like the hockey stick and then shoots straight up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And for us, that flatter growth, lower incline of growth period was a good 7 years.
Well, I work for an environmental engineering firm, and we have a group that does green building. We had some LEED certified individuals. And here's what we face when we would go try to sell this to a potential client or a municipality or an institution. We typically get three questions or kind of a pushback in three different ways. First is the ROI question, right? Why should I spend a dollar today? That in case, you know, in the sense that I'll save $1.25 3 or 4 years down the road. Okay. The next one was, we're already doing this, Chris. You know, we print on both sides of the paper, and we use soy-based toner, and we have a hybrid parking spot. So we're all over this environmental thing. Thanks for coming in. And then the last thing is, what does the regulation say? Because so much in the environmental world is based on local, state, federal regulations. If the client doesn't see any regulations requiring them to be green or environmentally responsible, then why am I doing it? I don't know if you face similar things, but these are the kind of things I face as an environmental consultant.
Yeah, I have so many scars all over my body from those battles. I used to get so pissed off in those early flatline years. I'd wear a green suit and a green tie just to piss them off. But I'd come in, it would just be a matter of time till they looked at me and thought, your three things and more. But
right.
how much is this dude in the green suit costing us?
Right.
How much is he going to delay us? And how much risk is he walking into this room? And so, and as you say, they already think they're pretty good, especially if you're in an area like California with a good building code. They say, well, I meet Title 24 already, and we don't have the money because this is going to cost more, and we're meeting the regulations, so we don't have to do it. So they all rationalize it. So the goal of the green engineer or the green architect is to convince them, one, it's a good investment in ROI.
Right.
Two, we're not going to push on the budget, and in fact, over time, you're going to make money. And even in some cases, you can have first cost savings. You can have a smaller mechanical system, less lighting, if you super insulate the building. You can, and I've done that for the city of San Diego in their Ridgehaven building, one of my first projects. You can make the building worth more, either leasing faster for tenants or higher comfort so the vacancy rate's lower. And you can take a building that might be a B building or B plus and make it an A when you go to sell it. And in terms of regulations, you know, they are changing, and so do you want to invest a huge amount of money and build something that isn't lasting for the future? But what we found over time, like at the city of Seattle, who was the first city to do green building and mandate it, initially is about a 4% increase for their own buildings, like libraries and civic halls. And then after they had done several green LEED buildings at the silver level, they found the cost come down towards zero.
Really?
Okay. So with your real estate background, did that impact how you approached this issue or how you spoke to people about it, you know, just having that perspective?
Yes, Nell, it really did. It was imperative to understand the industry. So I had been a developer. We had been financing and building buildings, selling buildings, leasing buildings, rezoning land. And so just that whole process, you really understand finance and legal contracts and bidding and how to make things work. And you can speak the vocabulary.
Right.
If you don't know the language of the game, you can't sell something new. And in fact, you have to figure out how it's to their advantage.
Right.
And by being steeped in that field, I could speak their language. I wasn't coming into green building as an environmentalist. I think it was imperative. Excuse me. The other thing I had learned was we were business people, and it was about the buck. And so that mentality we brought into USGBC, and even though it was a nonprofit, we ran it always like an entrepreneurial business. And coming from Stanford and sitting right next to Silicon Valley, I had that startup mentality. And so we weren't just looking for donations and handouts. We were making, looking to make money from multiple revenue sources with recurring revenue. And looking at the market and speed to market and innovation and scrappiness, all the things that Google has embraced.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with David Gottfried. He's the author of Explosion Green, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry. It's available on paperback. It just rolled out yesterday, I believe. Congratulations, David, first on your book.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris.
Let's look at some of the challenges, you know, as you got LEED rolled out initially. This was back in, the late 90s that LEED certification was launched?
Yes, you're right on.
How's it evolved? What were some of the lessons that you learned in setting up the certification process and the scoring system, et cetera?
Many lessons learned. First, how do you build the guideline itself?
Yeah.
What are the categories that are important to define green building? And then in a given category, such as energy efficiency or water or health, what are the sub-categories you want? And then what standards are you going to use? Are you going to make up your own or look for credible third-party standards that you'll look at? And then what kind of game are you playing? Is it just a guideline is there a third-party certification at the back end? And who certifies? And what happens if you find people didn't meet the levels and said they did? And
yeah.
And where do you even set the bar for LEED certified versus platinum?
Right. And having worked in South Florida, now living out here, you know, climate in different regions of the country probably affect that scoring system too, right? With respect to materials or water or energy use?
Sure. The desert is different than Alaska. And earlier versions of LEED didn't regionalize, and there are lessons to be learned for later versions. In Australia, they created Green Star, learning from LEED, and also a system in the UK called BREEAM. And they had, I think it's 7 different bioregions with credits that could float and be tailored.
Hmm.
When we did LEED in India, water became more important.
Right.
Sure. So what do you see, you know, looking a few years down the road? What's next for LEED?
Well, LEED has just come out with version 4, and that's getting more into products and materials, and we call it HPDs, health product declarations. And there's a big revolution now of what are the ingredients in the building products, and do they make people sick? And are there certain ingredients that should not be there? And so LEED is moving in that direction. They've just invented something called the LEED dynamic plaque. And it's a new question, is LEED a static rating such as platinum or silver? Or is it something that should change over time? Can you get better as your energy efficiency and water efficiency improve? Can you get worse if you don't live up to the standard that you were certified at? And so we're looking at the data flows and even real-time streaming of energy, water, waste.
You know, that's one of the things I was going to ask about, because there's always some sort of ongoing critique of LEED, which is probably a compliment to the system itself, mm-hmm. that people just want to continue to push it. But one of the things you hear is, okay, you get this rating, and then no matter how you operate the building or what you do in the future, you get to keep it as it stands now. Or, you know, it's not about the site itself. It's too much just about the building. Or,
right.
You know, how have you guys addressed, like, these kinds of concerns? Do you welcome those? Are they frustrating to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's... anything that gets really successful ends up with a lot of criticism. So there's been a lot of press. Do LEED buildings perform as intended?
Mm-hmm.
Do they improve over time? Are the credits weighted in the right areas? And even is the certification process accurate? Are there better ways to get to what Art Gensler calls the 80-20 rule? And so it all comes up. And I always tell people, where you are today is not where you'll be tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You got to start with the best you can do. But the key in improvement is to start and get in the game and then measure and collect your data and then have a continuous improvement path. And then come out with version 2 and version 2.2.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're in the game. We've done incredible. We can do better. And I still think we can streamline the certification process so it's less costly, less paperwork, and still get the results and even more, because it becomes more effective for everyone to use. And even the L in LEED stands for leadership. And originally our vision was the lowest bar was at the top 25% of all buildings could be LEED certified, and then less would be silver, gold, or platinum. But what about the other 75% of buildings, and even the big clunker buildings or homes, I call them? You know, in Weight Watchers, they don't say you can't join us because you weigh 500 pounds.
Right.
They hug you and embrace you and want you to get out of your couch and put on some tennis shoes, go out the front door and move your body.
Right.
And then weigh in and celebrate every 5% of improvement. And so we're now looking at the clunker homes and buildings beyond just LEED.
Yeah, so continual opportunities there. I like the fact that you're moving in. You went from buildings to homes and whole neighborhoods and institutions. I mean, there's a world of opportunity out there. It's still the mine as far as efficiency goes.
We have barely begun.
Right.
We're getting to the more elite buildings that are bigger and have budgets, more educated teams. And now there's just so much energy, water, and waste in older homes, mm-hmm. Older buildings. There's 5 million buildings commercially in the U.S., and we're playing with just a few hundred thousand. And so there's millions left that are 15,000 square feet, 50 years old, single-pane windows, and every BTU to heat or cool those buildings goes right out the windows or the walls because there's no insulation.
Right. That's my place. That's a lot of places here in Park City, residential-wise.
Yeah. So if people are interested in getting involved with LEED or building LEED or becoming certified, where should they go and how can they learn more?
Sure. If you go to usgbc.org, that's the site for the U.S. Green Building Council, and there's a navigation button for LEED, L-E-E-D. And you can download for free the various LEED rating systems, whether it's homes or new buildings. There's the LEED Green Associate Exam, and then there's a higher level called the LEED Accredited Professional. You can take those. You can get reference guides to learn, to study for them. There's our Green Build Conference. Click that or Google Green Build. It's in New Orleans this year in October, around the 22nd, and we'll have over 100 lectures and phenomenal keynotes and an expo of 900 booths of green products. There's also the worldgbc.org if you want to see who the 100 countries are mm-hmm. and get a sense there.
Great. Well, the name of the book, again, is Explosion Green, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry. And David Gottfried is the founder of the USGBC and the LEED certification process. David, thanks again for joining us on This Green Earth. We hope to stay in touch.
Yes, well, thanks for your good work and for getting the word out there and caring about our planet and its future.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Hey,
thanks, guys.
Thank you. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we've got some news items. And a new initiative here at the radio station. We'll talk all about that.
That's right. We'll be talking with Larry Warren.
All right. Stay tuned. We'll be back. It's This Green Earth.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to the ReStore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to the ReStore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. Mm-hmm. And in the studio with us now is Larry Warren, KPCW's general manager.
And I just have to chuckle every time I hear the theme music because I think of Fred Armisen and Portlandia.
Carrie Brownstein.
Exactly.
Carrie
it's
Portlandia.
So good.
It's
should we
yes,
just listen to that
stuff
for the rest of the display? Yeah.
At least a couple more minutes.
If there's a lull, go ahead.
But you're here for a reason, Larry.
I am. KPCW exists on listener contributions and some other sources of underwriting, of course, from our great sponsors, and also some federal grants and some money from county rap tax and things of that nature. And what we're finding is that pledge drives grow a little bit, but we've pretty much plateaued in the amount of money we can raise through pledge drives, and it's great. We love that support, and we especially love it because it lets everybody take part, and we get 800 to 900 people who call during pledge drive and give what they can.
That's an impressive number for a town of a small size.
It yeah, is, and it shows you know, just how loved KPCW is. But the realities are that the House of Representatives has voted to kill all public funding for public broadcasting. For us, that would be about a $150,000 hit. Now, the Senate does not go along with the House, if you've noticed lately. So, excuse me, that money is secure for now. But we have to look to the future, and we have to look to the future in other aspects too. Broadcasting's been around for about 100 years since Marconi invented the medium. We are a very mature industry, but we are in a new world, as everyone with a cell phone and a Pandora subscription and everything else knows. And we need to invest in new media and in driving content to new media. And what we're finding is the level of funding, the funding model we've always used, just allows us to get by. And it allows us to get by with terrific broadcasting. We were one of the finalists for a national award from the National Association of Broadcasters, the Crystal Media Award.
Nice.
Wow.
Crystal Radio Award. And there are thousands of radio stations, and we were one of a handful picked as one of the outstanding stations in America. And we know that, and listeners know that, but we know we have to stay ahead of the technology and content curve. So we are starting a new initiative to bring in a new level of donor to the station. Our average donation now is less than $100. But we know there are people who value public radio and value KPCW. We have a three-person news department. Now, I've spoken with colleagues in Philadelphia, the number five market in America, who in their public radio stations don't run a three-person news department. It is extraordinary, the resources we put into gathering local news here. And the other thing we do is create shows like This Green Earth and other shows like Mountain Money, Mountain Life, Cool Science Radio, Fun Friday, The Classified Show, the Local News Hour, where Park City wakes up and gets its news and information. These are all local productions. Now, a lot of in fact, most NPR affiliates run wall-to-wall NPR programming all day long. Right. We've chosen to keep the focus local, and we believe our niche is local programming. And so these are all ways of saying that we can get by with the level of funding we have, but we're not growing. We're not adding content. We're not able to feed all the new media that we need to feed. So we've started the KPCW Broadcasters Club, and we are inviting those who have the means. Certainly, if all you can do is throw us $25, we love it. You know, we've had kids come in with piggy banks, and it's just heartwarming.
Get them started early, huh?
Wow.
And you know, that $10 is so fun to get. But We are starting the Broadcasters Club and hope to find a cadre of Parkites who love public radio, who love what we're able to bring to the a mix of Park City every day, 365 days a year. So the Broadcasters Club is accessible by clicking on our homepage. We have a silver microphone logo. And we are asking those who can afford it to donate at the silver level of $1,000, the gold level of between $1,000 and $5,000, or the platinum level if you can go beyond that. We can break it down into monthly payments. Mm-hmm. That makes the $1,000 contribution $84 a month. And those who can afford it, I would urge you to step up to the plate and join the Broadcasters Club. Call me at the station. I'm here most every day. Give me a call or email me at lwarren@kpcw or call Cindy Kaiser, our underwriting director, as well at the station. And find out more about the Broadcasters Club. We have been floating this quietly in the community for about a month now.
Right.
We've signed up patrons at every level, but only a handful, and they were frankly our good friends that we knew would
sure.
would come through for us. But now we're casting a wider net and looking for more support and sustaining support. People who year in, year out will agree KPCW is valuable. It's unique. It's one of the great things in this community that makes this community great. How else do you learn about environmental issues?
Right.
How else do you learn about new businesses in town? How else do you learn what happened at last night's council meeting? You know, in the days right. before radio, when the elections were held, you had to wait 4 days to find out who the winners were until the newspaper came out.
Right. Now you find out before the polls are closed.
Well, at the close of polls.
Well.
And
a little exaggeration for the sake of
you know, and last week the Vail PCMR lawsuit.
Right.
You know, that broke on our schedule. We were able to get that information out immediately. The whole town learned of the results of that key lawsuit off of KPCW and our broadcast signal and our crack news department. So we're performing a unique service. We're a pretty unique station in America, as our nomination for the Crystal Award
right.
demonstrated. So I just would urge listeners to this show and KPCW throughout the broadcast day, go to our website, click on that silver logo, learn more about the Broadcasters Club. Give me a call. Give Cindy a call. We'd be happy to talk to you about great plans we have for the future that require funding.
I have an idea. Maybe if you join at the silver level, you get lunch with Nell and myself.
Absolutely.
And if you join,
or if you join at the gold level, you don't have to have lunch.
There you go. You never have to listen to this Green Earth again.
I was just going to say you get
keeping
lunch
you
just
up at night,
with Nell. You don't have to have lunch with me. But those are great ideas, and these are not unusual to other stations around.
No, you know, we've been remiss in not starting this sooner because a broadcaster's club, a giving circle, is
yeah.
pretty much standard in the public broadcasting realm. Park City community has been so generous that we have not felt a need until now to really get serious about seeking higher level donations and donations on a sustaining business. But, you know, the time is now. We need to we are out on mobile devices, but we need to be feeding newer, fresher content on all the devices we now service. And that requires money. And then when you look in the face of the future and see that politically public funding of public radio is tenuous, we need to learn how to live without a public subsidy. And I'm not saying whether a public subsidy is a good or a bad thing. It's just a reality that it may go away, and we need to face reality. You can argue both sides of that one politically, but the bottom line is simply if that goes away, it could go away in a day, and we would have a big budget hole to fill.
Well, this is a growing community that's going to have continue to have a number of issues that need to be covered by this station and a news crew. A crew, like say, of three that does that generates the news of five people. Let's say.
Well, consider and, that you know our news staff is the institutional memory of this town.
Yeah,
you know, Rick and Leslie have put in 20 plus years. Rick, 25 plus. He's up to about 27 years of broadcasting on KPCW.
Wow.
I mean, he knows everything that has gone before, and that kind of institutional knowledge is just irreplaceable.
Right.
Irreplaceable. And this community would be the poorer for not having the KPCW news team every morning helping to set the agenda for the things we talk about in town all day.
All right.
Absolutely. Well,
again, go to the station website.
Yeah, just kpcw.org. Click on the silver microphone, which is on the homepage, or give me a call. Give Cindy a call. We'd be happy to fill you in, and we'd be happy to induct you as a charter member of the Broadcasters Club.
Thanks.
Fantastic. Well, we hope some of our listeners can join your club.
We hope so, too.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take another break for a couple of underwriters. When we come back, we'll cover some of those news items, including yesterday's announcement from the White House and the EPA on carbon emissions from power plants. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is John with Park City Nursery.
And this is Kay with the Park City Tree Ranch.
Supporting KPCW since 1983.
Between the two locations, we carry a variety of products to help your yard and garden flourish, including living plants, yard art, seeds, bark, compost, and organic products. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. And time for some news items here. Of course, the big one yesterday.
That's right.
Do you want to
frame
the story before we get into it?
So this one, I'm sure that everyone that listens to KPCW has already heard about. If you listen to NPR, you know, if you read the paper, you will know this is happening.
It's wall to wall.
The Obama and the EPA proposed a new rule that would reduce carbon emissions 30% mm-hmm. by 2030 compared to 2005 levels.
Okay.
And there was some debate, of course, about whether it should be 2005 levels, which is when emissions were at their peak, or 2012
right.
levels when they
did
come.
Life was a giant party back then, and everybody
right.
was burning
burning coal left and right
as fast as they could.
Coal fires in the backyard.
So it's a high bar. They're saying it was a high bar at 2005, and to meet
right,
it
or
not as
it's not
difficult.
It's not going to be as difficult to meet 2005 levels, high right. bar, low bar,
low, okay.
as it would be to meet 2012 levels. But they went with the 2005 levels, and the rules that are proposed would give states – it doesn't prescribe how this has to happen. It would give states a variety of options mm-hmm. to try to meet those goals of that 30% by 2030. And so then over – you'll talk a little bit more about this, but over the next few years or over the next year, the public will have a chance to sort of advocate for a longer timeline or a shorter timeline or more cuts or fewer cuts. But I wanted to give the current energy profile, which is in 2012, coal supplied 37% of U.S. electricity. 30% came from natural gas. 19% came from nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm.
7% came from hydropower and 5 from renewable sources like wind and solar. And so, you know, we anticipate that this would change with this rule.
It should change.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, 74% of carbon emissions come from coal-fired power plants.
Come from that 37%
exactly.
Energy,
so when we get, exactly. Yeah. But and what's interesting, what the good news here is that just back in 2004, 10 years ago or so, 50% of our electricity came from coal-fired power plants. Now that's down to 37%. That was – no one back in 2004 saw that happening.
Expected such an immediate drop.
Yes. And, you know, and back in the 70s and 80s, it was even between 55 and 60% came from coal. So coal is kind of fading out. Power companies are transitioning out of coal. And these regulations will help – let's be honest, they'll help accelerate that transition and that phasing from coal-fired power plants. Okay. So here's a couple of things. These are the – kind of like I said, the 5 things that I thought that kind of came out of this. And you touched on some of these now already. But first, this proposal addresses existing power plants, not new power plants. There's already a set of draft regulations out for new power plants and control. So this is existing power plants only. And it's coal and natural gas because natural gas emits carbon dioxide too. But it's going to be more difficult for coal-fired power plants to meet these regulations. Secondly, like you said, now it's a draft rule. Okay, it's not finalized. It's still being reviewed and commented on. They have a whole year to finalize this thing, June 2015. And then, like you said, the states have another year to submit their plans on what they are going to do, because that's what states have. Each state will have to develop its own plan to reduce carbon emissions. And I think there's even some type of opportunity at the end of June 2016 to get an extension on that plan or so. If something
yeah.
Like, as usual. Okay. So this is not happening today. Okay. It's not a cap and trade or carbon tax. Those are some of the options states have, right? They have – again, this is up to states to develop a plan about how they're going to reduce their carbon emissions from power plants. And it could be cap and trade. It could be carbon tax. It could be efficiency programs. It could be incentives for renewables, et cetera. Okay. So that's
– yeah.
That's also out there.
You know, another big sort of aspect of this is focused on – health, on human health.
Hmm.
So the agency projects that the reductions in emissions will avoid 2,700 to 6,600 premature deaths and 140,000 to 150,000 asthma attacks in children. So you have a huge cost savings in the economy in that arena as well in healthcare.
That's a good point, because this is not just about carbon dioxide. This is about all the other things that are emitted from coal-fired power plants, PM10, PM2.5, mercury,
mm-hmm.
Traces of arsenic, lead, chromium, beryllium. These are all metals that are within coal, and they get emitted to some percentage out of the stack. Or worse, they remain behind in the ash, and the ash is a huge issue. We hear from stories in North Carolina and Tennessee about ash ponds, and those things have to be managed in perpetuity.
Right.
So there's a number of reasons why we need to phase and transition out of coal.
It'll be interesting to see how this impacts the air quality in the Salt Lake Valley.
Yeah. So there's a lot of good that can come out of this. And one last thing I want to bring up, you know, the Republicans, congressmen are talking about how this is going to ruin the economy. And let's say Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming was quoted as saying it'll kill coal and 800,000 jobs. Well, I looked at the U.S. EIA, that's the Energy Information Administration, that's the totally non-biased institution that tracks energy in this country. It's cited by both sides of the aisles. The last time they cited a number, 100,000 jobs in the mining industry. Okay, that's – Mike Enzi might say 800,000. You know, 100,000 jobs are in the mining industry. They're at risk in the coal mining industry, surface and subsurface industry. But it's not it, – and even 800,000 jobs is less than 1% of the number of jobs in this country.
You know, I read an interesting analysis on Forbes that talked about, okay, even if it is this 800,000 jobs, in any given year you would expect to lose – many, many times that number of jobs, and then they build in another area.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they said, obviously, it's a huge deal for those 800,000 people or 100,000, depending on how you look at those numbers. But in the overall scheme of things, that's a blip. That was the exact word, you know. So,
and some of these coal-fired power plants will be transitioned to natural gas, or there'll be other renewables. So, okay. All right. So I think we got that.
That's right.
Good. Let's. We got a few more minutes. Let's go to the GMO story.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So let me just grab this here. So two counties in Oregon voted to ban GMOs, genetically modified organisms, from being grown in their counties. These were ballot initiatives. Hmm. And in one particular case in Jackson, Oregon's Jackson County, some of the major agribusiness companies, of course, no surprise, got involved.
Right.
Dow, DuPont, Monsanto, Syngenta, and others contributed over $1 million to the campaign to vote against this. And of course, the local folks had a small fraction of that funding. But locally, you know, the big fact, I think, was that 95% of the money funding the campaign against this ballot initiative came from outside the county. And so the local folks and the local farmers were saying, you know, this is something that we want. And they felt very strongly about that. And so after they got this campaign going, however, the Oregon legislature enacted pretty quickly late last year you may have heard this referred to as the Monsanto Protection Act. And essentially, then that's like, of course, the critics calling it that. But it was like a preemption act. So right. It said that the counties can't make these decisions. These counties can't decide that they don't want to grow GMOs. That has to be made at a state level, which makes it a lot easier for bigger corporations to influence the process. So another county followed Jackson's act, and they will have a legal challenge on their hands, I'm sure. But it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Wow, that's good for them.
It is, and it's really impressive, I think,
good luck to them.
That it passed in the face of all that funding from those corporations.
All right, so we'll follow. Yeah. That's an ongoing story. We'll stay on top of that. Real quick, I did so want to mention that in northeastern China, in the Koreas, in last week, they experienced their highest temperatures ever in the month of May.
Ever.
Beijing recorded 104.4 degrees on a Thursday, last Thursday, but it was broken the next day when it reached 106 degrees. They had never seen temperatures like that in the month of May.
Wow.
So we'll probably get more of that. We'll give you a little more info on that next week. And Brian McInerney will be coming on in a couple of weeks to talk about the state of weather and climate here in the state and around
the globe. That's right, our seasonal update.
That's right. Hey, time to wrap up. We'll ask the underwriters. We'll come back to say goodbye. Stay tuned. It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law. LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap things up on another great show.
That's right.
Thanks again to Dave Gottfried, the author of Explosion Green, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry. And thanks always to our underwriters.
That's right. Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Vail Resort.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate.
You can always find us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
And email us your thoughts or comments or ideas for the show at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. I think that's it, no?
That's right. We managed to get it all in within the hour.
Good job to us. And again, our crack research staff.
That's
EJ
right,
Elliott. Thanks
Elliott.
To her, who gathers our news items. And remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City. Only on KPCW.